we started the Elitz theorem. Which states it is impossible to spontaneously break a local symmetry. And the reason why I put symmetry between quotes is because we will have a lot to say about in what sense gauge transformations are not a symmetry at all in quantum mechanics. But in classical physics, the situation is slightly different. We can think of a gauge transformation still as a real transformation on our physical variables, although this depends on the cases. But for a spin system, we can still think of it like that. And so we presented, so our local gauge transformations that are based at the site n of a cubic lattice in these spatial dimensions. They allow us to flip all the spins that come out from a site n. And we see that our invariant energy for this type of transformation is the sum over all the plaquettes that end of the just the product of our Ising variables that have value plus one and minus one. So let me write this notation. Okay, so we want to see that there is no spontaneous breaking, which means that there is no residual magnetization if we insert a field, an external field, H tilde, and then we compute the magnetization, we do the thermodynamic limit, we send H tilde to zero, and we want to see the magnetization is zero, okay? So last thing we said yesterday was we want to compute this object here. And I was using this notation for the links n nu in presence of the field H, okay? So this is the sum over all the speed configurations of what? Of this thing for the partition function, we have beta. Let me just consider j equal 1. It's not important. And I call H beta H tilde. And then we have the partition function here that is just the sum over all the configurations of just this term. Okay? Very good. Now, imagine we operate a gauge transformation at the site n that is the same n that appears here. Okay? So sigma z, this variable, whatever it is its value, is flipped. So it goes to sigma prime z, which is, let me use this notation L that labels the link, okay? But in our case, L is n nu, this L, which is minus sigma z L. Okay? And so we want to rewrite this object in terms of the new variables. Okay? So this one becomes minus sigma prime z L. This term here goes into itself because it's invariant under this transformation. But this one doesn't. Okay? So we need to rewrite that term. So let me define the way this term changes in this way. So this will be equal to h sigma prime, the sum of the new variables, minus the sum of some delta. Okay? And this delta, sigma z L, is just sigma prime z L minus sigma z L. And by using this, we see that this is equal to minus 2 sigma z L. And it is, so this is when it's L. But when L is another, so this is when L is one of the links that is connected to N. Okay? So let me call the set of links that belong to N. So this is n, let me call it ln. Okay, so this is true for these links. Otherwise, it's zero. Right? Because if I'm not flipping any variables, this term is not changing at all. So the delta is zero. Okay? Zero otherwise. Zero when L does not belong to this set ln. Okay, so let's plug these things inside here. And we get 1 over z, the sum over all the configurations. And we have minus sigma prime z, okay, at L. Then we have the exponential of what? Of beta. We have our prime variables. It's invariant, so it's okay. Then we have plus h sigma prime and minus this delta. Okay? So we've done a very simple transformation on a few variables. And we have rewritten the energy in terms of the new variables. Okay. Now you see that this is, since I'm summing over all the spin configurations, also all the flipped ones, this is the same energy that than the one at the beginning. So I can write this object as the expectation value of this quantity, right? Because I'm summing over all the configurations with this energy that is the same as before over the partition function. So this is the expectation value at a, with a field H of this quantity. Do you agree with this? OK. So now let me consider the difference between the expectation value of sigma zl, which is this with H, and the expectation value of the opposite. And I want to take this thing in absolute value. Okay, so what is this? So this is this thing, right? So this object is this thing. So this is equal to this thing, which is sigma ZL, which multiplies e to the minus sigma delta, sigma z, minus 1. At h. Okay, and this is smaller. Okay, so now let's look at this term. This delta sigma z is, so for every, each of these terms here is at most 2, right? It's at most minus 2. So with the minus here, it is at most plus 2. And of course, here I've forgotten an h, right? There was an h always. Sorry about that. Okay, so there is an h here. Okay, so there is at most, each of these terms is 2. And I'm summing over all the links. How many links do I have that come out from a node? 2D, where this is the dimension of the space. So this object here is bounded by so I can write that this thing is smaller than the expectation value of sigma z, which is what it is, we don't care, times in the limit that h goes to 0. OK, so first of all, notice that here, so we first take the thermodynamic limit. But nothing changes, because in this expression, the total number of spins doesn't appear. OK, so this is crucial. When we do it for the Ising model, we take the difference between these two things, we will, the n will show up. Here it doesn't show up. So I am taking the thermodynamic limit, which means doing nothing for this expression. And then I send my source, external source, to 0. And you see that this term goes to 0. So this goes to 0. So this means that this difference also has to go to 0, since it was upper bounded by 0. And it's a positive number, which means that the expectation value of sigma z is equal to the expectation value of minus sigma z. And being expectation values linear means the expectation value of sigma z is 0 at h, for h going to 0. Okay, so we cannot spontaneously break a local gain, a local symmetry. So yesterday, one of your colleagues asked me this very important question. So, but I want to discuss it now because it's very important. So I want you all you to see it. But wait a minute. We know that, I mean, there is the Higgs mechanism, right? Just got the Nobel Prize. The Higgs mechanism, we give mass to particles, and there is some local gauge symmetry, and we know that there is a finite value for the expectation value of some field that gives mass to the particles. So how is that possible that happens? Maybe this theorem doesn't hold for continuous fields, or something different happens in quantum field theory. No, what happens in the Higgs mechanism is that you first fix the gauge. When you fix the gauge, you are explicitly breaking the local symmetry. Okay? After you fix the gauge, what you get is a model which has a surviving global symmetry. And this one can be spontaneously broken with the usual mechanism that you know, because global symmetries can be broken. And that's how that mechanism works. But the local symmetry cannot be spontaneously broken. We have to fix the gauge and break it explicitly. Yep.
We fix the gauge ourselves, right? So nature does nature care about a gauge? Nature doesn't work in a particular gauge, so why is it important?
No, exactly. So the philosophy of this is that since local gauge transformations should not have some physical meaning, they cannot break spontaneously, because in some sense there is nothing to break. Whereas the global symmetry is a true symmetry, and the breaking of this true symmetry has physical effects. That means that there is ergodicity breaking, means that you cannot get out of a sector of your phase space. So that can explicitly break. So if you want, this is the philosophy of it, but you know, the theorem is this one. And so this is the simplest version for the theorem for a local symmetry that is Z2, but the original proof by Elitzur is not much more complicated than this. There is nothing much fancier other than having to be careful with a few more things if you go to more complicated symmetries. The essence is in this simple proof. Okay, so we have our. So we know that there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking for a Z2 gauge theory. Okay, so maybe, and there is no magnetization, right? So the system is paramagnetic. So maybe there is just, it's always paramagnetic at every temperature. So maybe we might just conclude that there are no phase transitions. There is just one phase. Because you remember, our question is, can we have phase transitions with beyond symmetry breaking? So here we have proven that there is no symmetry breaking, but we cannot conclude yet that there is a phase transition. So now we have to show that there is a phase transition in this model. And if there is, then we need something new to understand this stuff. Okay, so what are these two phases that are not distinguished by this? It's not like one is magnetized and the other one not. They're both paramagnetic. Okay. So let's first consider. So you know that in statistical mechanics, the most important thing is dimensionality. And what is true in the certain dimension changes completely with another type of dimension. So let's first consider the case d equal 2. So in d equal 2, we have a square lattice. And for sake of simplicity, let me consider periodic boundary conditions as usual. Okay, let me do one more row, column. Okay. And now let's see if we can do some gauge fixing here. So let me call these horizontal coordinates x and these vertical coordinates, that is like time, tau. Call them tau because at some point I want to imagine that I do the classical to quantum mapping and see what is the quantum version of this model. Using the transfer matrix method that we showed for the Ising model. But let's do some gauge fixing and let's consider as representative configurations only those configurations such that sigma z in n direction tau is equal plus one. Gauge fixing. So what does it mean that this is a gauge fixing? What I mean is that for every spin configuration, there is another one that can be obtained by applying many gauge transformations such that all the spins in the vertical directions are plus one. Can you see that? Can you see that? No matter what I put on these links, I can transform it by appropriate number of gauge transformations. So you can convince yourselves that this is true with a little thought. Okay, so now I am explicitly breaking. Yeah.
Reality. I mean, intuitively, that looks like two different possible ways reality could be. So it is the sort of the way you should think about that spin is kind of a global overall property, and only the relative spin properties have reality. Or
yes. So I'm refraining a little bit from this because I want to go there just. In 10 minutes about whether two different configurations that are connected by a gauge symmetry are or not the same reality, because I see you all push me in this direction. Just wait a little. We will discuss it thoroughly in the quantum case. So for now, we have no reason to believe that two different configurations of spins that are connected by gauge transformation are not physical. There is nothing that we have done that says, oh, one is physical and one is not. The very fact that we are thinking about measuring the magnetization of one spin means that the spins, they are physical. So I can distinguish two different configurations. Only they have the same energy. So I cannot distinguish them by the energy. But that doesn't mean that I cannot distinguish them in other ways. What I'm saying is that if I consider configurations that have plus one, because they're connected by a gauge transformations, then all the averages will be the same. All these expectation values are the same. So now you can again raise the question, oh, but if all the averages are the same, does it mean that it's, they're equivalent physically? I will discuss this in the quantum setting when things are much clearer. So I just want you to show what happens to this model when you have gauge fixing. Okay, so when you have gauge fixing, this piece, so let me be boring here. So this is n. This is n plus mu. This is n plus mu plus nu, and this is n plus nu. Remember the labeling of our sites. The variable here is sigma z n, n plus mu. And the variable here is sigma z n plus nu. And then mu, right? And then I have those here. And my plaquette is the product of these four. But these two, spare me to write exactly what they are, after gauge fixing are plus one. So my energy after gauge fixing becomes minus j, the sum over all n and nu mu, of just sigma z n plus nu mu, and sigma, let me write this one first, sigma z n plus mu. So basically, I am coupling these two spins in this direction. And I'm summing over all these parts. And then I change row, sorry, I change column, and I do it here. So this is what? This is just the Ising model in 1D repeated many times. Let me say like this. So the 2D Ising gauge theory is equivalent to the 1D Ising model. We see it by gauge fixing. Now, this model, just as I was mentioning before, it's the Ising model. So it has a global symmetry that is residual. That can be exactly spontaneously broken. And so if you wish, this is the Higgs mechanism for a Z2 field. Okay. But we also learned something else, that there are no phase transitions. Because in the Ising model, the classical Ising model in 1D, there are no phase transitions for any finite temperature. There is only one phase, which is paramagnetic. Yeah?
Yeah, so what is the breaking of that symmetry? Which phase transition does that correspond?
To the one, the usual one,
the thing. But we just showed that this is equivalent to a whole bunch of 1D Isings don't have phase transition.
At finite temperature.
It has a phase transition at zero temperature. Right. So there are no phase transitions at finite temperature. There is only the residual one that it can only happen zero temperature in which you can spontaneously break the global Z2. Yeah?
So I'm slightly skeptical about the fact that you can always gauge fix all the vertical links to be plus one, because every gauge transformation kind of preserves the parity of the number of minus ones that I have. If I initially have an odd number of minus ones on the verticals, then stay like that.
No, it preserves the parity in the plaquette.
Because it depends, like, when you do several plaquettes, it depends, like, how many sides belong to both of them.
Isn't the transformation, though, a star?
Yeah, my gate transformations are defined on the vertices. And Every time I perform one to the vertex, I only have two. I have two links going.
But some of them will belong to two different vertices that you flipped, and some won't. So that changes the parity.
Okay. So
No, so I understand. You're saying, oh, so.
Suppose I have initially a single minus one on a vertical link.
No, I understand, but it doesn't preserve the parity along the vertical speeds. It preserves the
total parity.
The spin above and the spin below.
Yeah, it also preserves the parity. It also preserves the individual parities.
So you're saying also in the
tau direction, the parity. So I cannot connect. Okay, yeah. Then I have to start from the sector in which you have an even number of spin flips in the tau directions. Okay, I agree. So in that sector, the gauge fixing gives you the isomorph. Okay. So how do we argue that there is a phase transition maybe in the equal tree? Because there is. Well, and we know that every time we compute something like the magnetization, we will not see a difference. So what else is left to do? What else can we do? So let me put it in another way. Every quantity that is not gauge invariant will have average zero, expectation value zero. This is what Elitzur theorem says. So if we want to see something that is not zero, we must look at something that is gauge invariant. And what are the only quantities that are gauge invariant? You said it yesterday, at the Wilson loops, right? So we choose a contour, C, and we compute the product of sigma z along this contour. So this is the Wilson loop. And we take the average of this. And we try to see what happens at high temperature and low temperature. Let me call A the area inside here. So the topic of your tutorial will be to compute this expectation value for the model in D equal 3. So in D equal 2, you will see that these two expansions give you the same answer. And the same answer is exp to the minus c. But for D equal 3, you have two different answers. Just a second. So this is called the area law, and this is the perimeter law. And they cannot be connected analytically one into the other. So there is a phase transition in D equal 3. Yes?
Sorry, with this model, do the periodic boundary conditions imply that when you flip a spin on the edge, the one at it?
No, there are periodic boundary conditions, right?
Yeah.
OK, so?
So does that mean that when you flip a spin,
uh-huh,
when you apply the transformation to one of the points on the edge,
yeah,
the spin at the opposite
edge.
So
if I apply it here,
yeah,
I'm flipping this, and this.
Yeah, because if that is true, then you can start from a single spin and flip everything up. Because when you, like, if that one in the middle is down, you can then flip it up, and then you can flip the edge ones. And then, so you don't have to start with any of
them. You have to identify the vertices on the edge as well.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah.
So it does work if you use the periodic boundary conditions.
Okay.
When you divide the Wilson loop, we're thinking on the closed paths on my lattice.
But if I have periodic boundary conditions, I have two non-trivial loops,
right? Yeah. Hold on the top.
Okay. Very good. So at this level, no matter whether it's contractible or not, you have this thing. So this signals that there is a phase transition. Okay? So it is very instructive and beautiful to do this expansion. This is a problem that I like very much. So you will discuss in the tutorial. All right, so there is a phase transition. So this is really non-trivial as a fact. We know that in the 2D Ising gauge theory, in the 3D Ising gauge theory, there is a phase transition, but the Elitzur theorem works in every dimension. So, but there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking.
Sorry, Nima, can you say it again louder?
So, yeah, so his question is, how do you define the area in 3D for a loop? Well, so first of all, you can
just embed it in the continuum, and then you count the spins that are intersected by this.
Yeah. And then you just count.
And actually, doesn't matter because it doesn't matter that it's the exact minimum. As long as it is within the lattice spacing, doesn't change the number of spins that intersects it. But anyway, I could just limit, just to make things simpler, I could always limit myself in taking loops along some plane, right? Because I don't care to have this generality. I just want to show that there are two different things that I can compute and that cannot be connected analytically one into the other. So this works even in just one plane. So, but if you want to do it in a more complicated way, yeah, a sensible definition is that you embed it, you take the smallest surface, and then you count the number of spins that are inside. Okay, but now we want to, so we know that there are phase transitions without symmetry breaking. And now we want to understand what happens at the quantum level. So QPT, because this is our real goal, to understand it in a quantum mechanical system without symmetry breaking. Okay. So do we have a quantum gauge theory? And does it have the same properties? Okay, so we finally can tackle this topic. So what does it mean to have a gauge theory in quantum mechanics? So there is the correct point of view is, of course, what you guys have mentioned many times, that two different gauge configurations describe the same physical state. So how do we do that? And how does it happen? So let's start with a very simple example. A quantum mechanical system is not just given by a Hamiltonian, but as I stressed many times in these lectures, is a Hamiltonian with a Hilbert space. And this matters a lot, especially. So the gauge structure is somehow the specification of the Hilbert space. So imagine that you have a free particle on a line in some periodic potential. So what is the Hamiltonian? Would be p squared over 2m plus v cosine 2 pi x over a. But what is our Hilbert space? Our Hilbert space would be the set of all the cats labeled by x, with x being some real number. And to every different real number, I describe a different state of the system, being my particle here, or here, or here, in general, in the position x. And to every label corresponds a different physical state. Now, what is a symmetry of the system? It's some operator. For instance, let me define the translation operator, which to the state x gives me translated of a quantity y. Okay? So this is some operator. And you immediately see that this state, which is x plus a, has the same energy than the state x, because we are in a potential that is periodic by a. Or in other words, TA and H commute. So the state X and the state X plus A have the same energy. But there are two different states. One is the particle here. One is the particle here, if this is A. And I can measure it because I can make the measurement that is the projection onto that state. And these two states are orthogonal. Okay. So they are two different physical states. So TA, we say, even if we cannot distinguish these two physical states by the energy, they can be distinguished by the projection onto that state. So TA is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. It means that there are two states that have the same energy. This is what it means. But now let's describe the free particle on a circle of length A. OK, so we cannot use this Hilbert space here. So this is the Hilbert space of a particle on a line. But the Hilbert space of the particle on a circle, we can describe it like this. We have all the x with x in R such that x plus a is x. So we are identifying two different labelings being the same physical state. So the projection onto either of these two labels gives you the same thing. It's the same physical state. So this is called the gauge structure. We need a gauge structure to describe a particle on a circle. We need to identify, to describe in terms of numbers a circle, we have to put these periodic boundary conditions, right? We have to identify different points. And this is all there is. So these are the same states. Now, what happens to the, I can still put a periodic potential, right? I can still put this Hamiltonian. But now the fact that H and TA commute is not a symmetry anymore. It's a requirement. The Hamiltonian must be compatible with the gauge structure. I will say in a moment why. But this is not saying that two different states, x and x plus a, have the same energy, because they are the same state. So it's not a symmetry, because this is just a gauge transformation. TA is x at the operator that transforms x in x plus a, that moves me within the set of labels. So it's an operation within the gauge structure, which is, has no physical meaning. Why the Hamiltonian has to commute with the gauge? The gauge transformation between labels. Because imagine that I have a state psi that belongs to my H circle. And now imagine that my H does not commute with my gauge transformation. Then H psi will be some other vector phi. Okay? And now what happens to TA phi? Well, TA phi is equal to TA H psi. And this is different in principle because these two operators do not commute from H TA psi. But TA psi is again the same state psi. So, and this is phi. So we see that if H does not commute with TA, by applying H to a physical state, we get a state TA phi that is different from phi. So we get out of our space of physical states. So if the Hamiltonian is the Hamiltonian on this Hilbert space, it must commute with the gauge transformation. Otherwise, we get out of this Hilbert space. Who wanted to ask a question? There was some question pending? OK. Ah, you.
Go
from 0 to pi, say, then you wouldn't have this issue. Right. Yeah. So. But now we see how we do a gauge structure. The way we do the gauge structure is to start from some larger set of labels. So if you wish, from a larger Hilbert space. And then we project down to a smaller set of labels. And in this way, we can define a gauge structure. If I start directly with something that is one to one, it's a perfectly viable description of our model. But we don't see the gauge structure. OK, now let's see a real example. And that is the lattice quantum Z2 gauge theory. So we want to mimic what we did with the Isinger gauge theory. So we have our square lattice with the periodic boundary conditions. So let's start with the d equal 2. But of course, you can do it in any number of dimensions. And OK, so what is our total Hilbert space? We put a spin 1 half on every link of the lattice, just like before. Now it's a quantum spin. So this is the tensor product of C2 at every link of the lattice. If I have L sites in each direction, then I have L square nodes. That means 2 L square links with periodic boundary conditions, which means that this L goes from 1 to 2 L square. Do you agree? So the dimension of the total Hilbert space is 2 to the 2 L square. We have 2 L square spins, 1 half. So this is the total Hilbert space. is the one that then we want to make a projection to make a gauge structure. This is like the line in the previous example. And you remember our gauge transformation. It was this Gn that was flipping all the spins. And we already made the work of defining it in a quantum-like way. So let me write it like this. This is the gauge local gauge transformation we want to define. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Periodic boundary conditions.
Right,
yeah.
The states, right? I mean, the form of the states, but for these type of models, boundary conditions specify
no.
topology, right?
Yeah, this is not before I was putting boundary
conditions on the space of states, right? Now I'm just putting boundary conditions on this lattice, and right now I'm counting all the spins on the lattice, and the only reason why I'm putting boundary conditions right now, later I will use it in other ways, but right now is because with boundary conditions, the counting of the links in terms of the counting of the nodes is easy.
Yeah, but changing the boundary conditions changes the topology of your lattice. That changes a lot of things.
True.
True. So we're just considering one example.
So yeah, we will see that
all I want to stress now is that it is not these boundary conditions that are giving the gauge structure. So the boundary conditions here are not playing the same role that they were playing in the sample of the particle on the line. Those boundary conditions were the gauge structure. Right now, the boundary conditions are just a convenient way for the sake of counting. Then they will have further effects, but they are not the gauge structure per se. So the gauge structure is given by this thing. And now this is a local gauge transformation. The one before was some gauge structure in which there was no notion of locality. We were not applying the transformation in some specific point of a lattice, okay? So this is our gauge transformation. And then we define our H gauge by means of a projection. So this is the set of psi that are in the total one, but not all of them. We project down to those such that Gn psi is equal to psi. So those that are invariant under the gauge transformation. So this is now the gauge structure. So now you see, imagine that I have a psi that is describing a spin configuration. So for every spin, I say if it's up, down, down, up, 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 so on and so forth. This is definitely a state inside here, right? Because this is the Hilbert space of the spins. In fact, I can use this as a basis for this Hilbert space. But it is not in here. Because when I flip four spins on one of the spins configurations, I obtain a different state. So these are not the states in the gauge invariant Hilbert space are not the spins configurations. The spins configurations are not physical at all. The only physical states are those that respect this property. So we have to understand what are the local degrees of freedom within this H gauge. The former one was given from the beginning a local structure. It's the Hilbert space of that is the product of these all these local Hilbert spaces that are the spins. But here we don't know yet. We've done a projection, and now we do not know who are the degrees of freedom. We have to find out. So in order to find out, let's first understand how many degrees of freedom we have in there. Or in other words, what is the dimension of this Hilbert space? So the dimension of H gauge is what? So we start from this one, right? And then we are making projections. What are these projections? So I am projecting on the state psi such that the eigenvalue of gn on this state is plus 1. Right? So what is the corresponding projector? The projector onto this state, let me call it pn. Okay, exercise. It's 1 plus gn over 2. Exercise show that this is indeed the projector onto this thing. Now look that all the pn commute. It's very easy to see that they all commute. They are all made of sigma x operators, and they all commute among each other. So this means that every time I do a projection, I can do all of them independently, because the order in which I make them doesn't matter. They all commute. And I am making a certain number of them, right? In principle, L squared. So I am constraining. It's just like when I do a projection in geometry. Every time I do a projection, I go onto an hypersurface that has some dimension less. In this case, it's V half, right? Because I am projecting onto a Hilbert. This thing has two possible eigenvalues, plus 1 and minus 1. So every time I project onto the eigenvalue plus 1, I half the dimension of my Hilbert space. The only thing you have to be careful is that because of the boundary conditions, now they play a role, the product over, oh, this is, a, let me call it this P. The product of all this GN on the whole lattice is the identity. Can you see that? If I multiply this operator x, 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 x. For this operator x, 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 I have x squared here becomes the identity. Then I keep multiplying and I cancel this two. Okay, again, this x is here. So the interior becomes the identity. And when I wrap around the torus, everything is the identity. So the product of all of them is the identity, which means that there are only L squared minus 1 independent ones, because the last one is equal to the product of all the others, since the product of all is the identity. With periodic boundary conditions, because of the periodic boundary conditions. OK, so I am applying L squared minus 1 constraints. I am halving the dimension of the Hilbert space L squared minus 1 times. So the total dimension is the initial one minus the number of times I have it halved, which is 2 to the L squared plus 1. I will steal 5 minutes because I don't want to stop here. So this means that if we want to write our H gauge like the tensor product of spin-like variables that are not based on the links, but are based somewhere else, but they have two eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1, I will need L squared plus 1 of them. So who may they be? Who are these good degrees of freedom? They are not the spins, right? Because the spin configurations are not in this state, in this space. So any suggestion? What are the physical degrees of freedom? The spins are not physical anymore. You guys have said it for 2 days in a row. Now you don't want to tell me. What are the physical degrees of freedom? Huh? Are the plaquettes. The plaquette operators, so whether they are plus one or minus one, are physical. So let me define the plaquette operator. Let me call it BP. Just like we defined it before, right? The product of sigma z around the plaquette P. So you see that it commutes with our gauge transformation. Right? It was constructed in this way from the beginning in order to commute. The product of sigma z around the plaquette doesn't change if I flip two spins. And which means that as operators, they commute. You can also see it in this way. I have sigma z, sigma z, sigma z, sigma z. When I apply transformation here, this is sigma x, sigma x. And then it's sigma x somewhere else. It doesn't matter. But you have two pairs of anti-commutations that you have. Two anti-commutations, zx, zx, so they commute. Hold on a second. So because these quantities cannot be changed by gauge transformation, then I can use them to label the state. So I can imagine that my Hilbert space is the tensor product of these variables, of all the BPs. Yeah?
Dimension is L squared plus one.
Yeah.
L squared plaquettes, right?
Yeah.
That's a plus. But you have a plus one there. I mean, there's still one.
Yeah.
And still, yeah. So another thing, you said that, okay, the physical degrees of freedom are those that, let's say, commute in this case with the local gauge transformation. But what about if I consider, again, the gauge operators to be my physical degree of freedom? Because it commutes with itself, right?
Your gauge operators do not describe a space. Your gauge operator in this Hilbert space are fixed to a value plus one. I have nailed them. There is nothing more, there's nothing. What can change value are the BPs. The BPs can have a value plus one or minus one, and so they can label a state. But now there is a problem of counting, right? We have only L square of them. And moreover, for the same reason of this constraint, you have the same constraint on the BP. Also, this is one. It's even easier to see that when you multiply squares everywhere, then it becomes one. So we have only L square minus one BPs. So when I want to write a basis for my Hilbert space, so I could write that H gauge is the span of these of vectors that have this form, BP1, BP L square minus one. Right? So I can specify the eigenvalues of these objects. And then I miss 2 degrees of freedom. Let me call them W1 and W2. Because I can label only L square minus one out of L square plus one. So I have 2 missing. So right now, my Hilbert space is the tensor product of all these local Hilbert spaces, because they're localized in a plaquette, right? It's the flux in the plaquette. We say there is a flux if it's minus one, and there is no flux if it's plus one. But we have 2 degrees of freedom missing. So and they must be gauge invariant quantities, right? Otherwise, they don't label the correct states in the Hilbert space. So where are these other 2 gauge invariant quantities that are independent from these ones? So if you consider the non-contractible loop around this direction and this direction, so the Wilson loops, so it's the product of sigma z around these two loops. Because they are Wilson loops, they commute with my gen. So they are gauge invariant quantities. And because they are non-contractible, you can play a little bit and show that there is no way of writing one of these operators as the product of other plaquettes. Because no matter how you have a product of plaquettes, you get loops that are contractible. So these are the two missing ones. Let me call them W1 and W2. So the Hilbert space of the quantum gauge theory is the product of L square minus one local Hilbert spaces times two things that are very non-local. So we may question whether a quantum gauge theory can be physical at all if we want, you remember, we wanted not only our Hamiltonians to be local, but our Hilbert spaces should have a tensor product structure that is local in itself. So it is weird. You should feel uneasy. So this is an indication that somehow these theories, either they do not exist in nature, or they must be emergent, which is the topic of tomorrow. Yeah?
So here, having the periodic boundary condition allows you to have these two Wilson loops that are non-trivial. But what about if instead of having the torus, I have a cylinder?
Then you do not have this problem of counting. With a cylinder, you have only one missing.
It's
a non-contractible.
Just one.
Just one.
On the sphere, there will be, it's still periodic, it's still close boundary conditions, but there are no non-contractible loops on the sphere. Or I can repeat the construction with more holes and have many non-contractible loops.
That depends on the homotopy group of the surface.
Correct.